Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And Minute 20 already. Here we are, a third of an hour into the show, and it keeps going and going. I think this is where the pace really starts picking up. There's a lot more. I mean, we've slowed it, kind of like a, I know I'm always using railroad terms, but it's like a just a freight train just starting to get its speed. It's gotten over the inertia and it's kind of chugging along now. And now that we've got, now that we're finding out what the Tesseract, well, let's get into a little bit what the minute is with the Tesseract. Hal, you want to do some accents here for us?
Absolutely. Always happy to put myself out there. All right, minute 20. In the Hydra laboratory, the air crackles with residual energy as Dr. Arnim Zola stares at the machine, his voice trembling with unease. What was that? Johann Schmidt, his face lit by the eerie glow of the Tesseract's power, gazes at the humming device with a predatory smile. I must congratulate you, Armin, he said, his voice laced with menace. Your designs do not disappoint, so they may require some slight reinforcement. Zola's eyes widen, his fear giving way to awe as he studies the readings. The exchange is stable, amazing. The energy we have just collected could power my designs. All my designs. This will change the war. Schmidt's expression darkens, his voice cold and resolute. Dr. Zola, this will change the world. The scene shifts to the dusty training grounds of Camp Lehigh, where the sun beats down on rows of recruits. A trainer's voice bellows in the distance. Ready, exercise, as soldiers move in unison. Peggy Carter, poised and commanding in her crisp uniform, steps forward, her British accent cutting through the air. Recruits, attention. Gentlemen, I am Agent Carter. I supervise all observations for this I got to take that again, Jim.
You got to make it sound a little less German, too.
Yes.
I know, exactly. I'm sorry.
Werner von Carter.
Yes. It's hard to switch.
It's okay.
Okay. So I'm just going to take it from her line again.
Sure.
Beep, beep, beep. You are cutting these, right?
Yes.
Okay, no, this part is not interesting.
No, this part is mighty.
This is the solid gold.
Welcome to the green room. Right. Yes.
Recruits, attention. Gentlemen, I am Agent Carter. I supervise all operations for this division. A cocky recruit, Gilmore Hodge, smirks from the line, his voice dripping with mockery. What's with the accent, Queen Victoria? And there we are.
Wonderful. Yes. Wow. Well, it's a stunning change of pace from the snow-capped mountains of possibly Austria to the dusty training grounds of Camp Lehigh, which is now, correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, back in the 40s, Captain America's Camp Lehigh, I think, was somewhere outside Virginia. I think it was like Camp Belvoir or somewhere in the outskirts. A lot of his activities, that was like his kind of secret headquarters, if I'm understanding my history of Captain America correctly.
Boy, I would have to go consult my my volumes in the back shelf to be sure. I mean, they got him into Europe pretty quick.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
A lot of his time during the war was spent bivouacking in tents with Bucky, you know,
right?
Who in the books, of course, is like a 14-year-old kid.
Yeah, yeah. That wouldn't fly nowadays, I think.
But I don't know where. I don't remember where Private Steve Rogers trained.
Yeah, from what I've been reading, at least what the internet tells me, because I don't know the comic books, but what the people who've supposedly read the comic book said was that it was kind of the equivalent of Fort Belvoir, which is in it's in Springfield, Virginia, just south of our nation's capital.
And yeah, I would trust him on that.
He would use that. And I was not aware of this, but he kind of had a Clark Kent alter ego. Like he would be Steve Rogers as well as being Captain America.
The Army didn't know that Steve Rogers was Captain America. I think maybe one commanding officer did, but Steve Rogers wasn't a captain, first of all. He was a private.
Yeah.
And he's going through the war as a private. So I don't know where he got the authority to just kind of slip away and become Captain America. But that was more or less his operations
Yeah, I just
his MO, that's the word I'm looking for, MO.
Yeah, I just wasn't sure. I didn't know that he had an alter, like, I guess it's not an alter ego if it's really him, but then so it was Clark Kent. Yeah. But yeah, he kind of kept it on the down low. So no,
that's an interesting thing that the Marvel movies did, is they really paid very little respect to the secret identity, the whole idea of a secret identity. Everybody knows Steve Rogers is Captain America in the MCU. Nobody knew Steve Rogers was Captain America. In fact, I'm not sure even if they still do in the comic books. There have been times when his identity has been revealed and then everybody in the world forgets it. And then it's been revealed. But the movies, I think quite sensibly just said, to heck with all that. Why does Steve Rogers need a secret identity? And it was actually, not to get too deep into comics lore, but...
Oh, no, please do.
Jack Kirby and Stan Lee were among the first, I think, in all of comics writing to say, when they invented the Fantastic Four, let's not give these people secret identities. They're just, Reed Richards and Sue Storm and Johnny Storm and Ben Grimm, and that's your Fantastic Four. They dispensed with the whole secret identity. And at the time, that was a real head turner.
But it's interesting, Brian, you point that out, because, right out of the gate, as we go into the MCU with Iron Man, of course, there's the wonderful moment at the end where Tony Stark just throws all caution to the wind, throws the convention out the door and says, no, I am Iron Man. And you've got kind of that in the Fantastic Four on one side. And then later when we start interacting with Peter Parker as Spider-Man, there is that whole thing where we've got to make the whole world somehow forget who he was, because for the kid, his secret identity getting exposed was hugely problematic.
Right, right. And yeah. They make that distinction that if you've got people in your life who would be hurt by the revelation, then the secret identity makes sense. But otherwise, right. The MCU, and I think, again, to its credit, said, why bother with it?
Yeah, just too much to think.
But you're right, Jim. During the war, Captain America did have... not everybody knew Steve Rogers was Captain America.
Yeah, so he and he worked out of Camp Lehigh on parts of things with Bucky as his faithful sidekick. But from the way the MCU, the way Marvel is treating this in the movies, is that it is somewhere in New Jersey, possibly a simulacrum of Fort Dix, New Jersey, which is just south and east of Trenton. I think this comes from Stan Lee's own experience. In World War II, Stan Lee went through basic training at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, which is toward the Jersey Shore. It's south of Red Bank. Anybody who's watched any of the Kevin Smith new movies would know where Red Bank and Leonardo, New Jersey is. It's just south of there is where Stan Lee did all of his basic training and his initial entry into the armed forces was there. So I think his understanding of Camp Lehigh and how it later manifests itself is a New Jersey training base. Hal, you would probably know Fort Monmouth, where Stan Lee went, from its proximity to a nearby Navy base, Lakehurst, New Jersey.
Oh, sure. So, yeah, the Zeppelin base and the final resting place of the Hindenburg.
That's right, yeah, and nowadays, it's all thanks to all the base conflations, the reassignments. It is now Fort Dix, Fort Monmouth, and Lakehurst are a joint operating base through
central. Joint base,
yeah.
See that a lot of places. We saw that with the Army base and the Air Force base in Tacoma, Washington, my old stomping grounds, is now Joint Base Lewis-McChord. It was Fort Lewis and McChord Air Force Base.
But. Yeah, so they're all. You know, I mean, that's now the Camp Lehigh we know and right. in the movies, it's funny how this is Camp Lehigh is going to play a major part in a bunch of the future movies. So we need to know that it's there simply all the way through to Endgame that it's going to be playing parts.
Yeah, it's one of those little nexus points in the universe, isn't it?
Which is really interesting because it's, in this film, it could simply be boot camp anywhere. We've got to show this guy, we got to show a little bit of boot camp so that, maybe a training montage is what you might expect. And then comes out the other side and he goes on about his business and we maybe never go back there again. So it really is interesting that we are giving it a little bit of attention here. And as you say, knowing down the road, it's going to play a more prominent role.
While we're talking, because we didn't prepare this thread of conversation earlier, but You know, Captain America was created by Joe Simon and Jack Kirby. Stan Lee was not involved in his actual creation. Jack Kirby served in World War II in the Army. Looking here, Joe Simon enlisted in the U.S. Coast Guard and got his training at Long Beach Island
LBI, yeah.
Yeah, and off in New Jersey.
Yeah, yeah, it's right next to the barn. I'm being a Jersey boy, there is, when people visit Long Beach Island, or LBI as it's known to the locals,
yeah.
There's a single highway running into LBI, and there are two paths that you can go when you get to the end of the bridge. You either go left or you go right. And when people ask where you're from in LBI, you say, oh, I go right or I go left. And basically left is super upscale, and to the right is the great unwashed live to the right. So no offense to the people in South LBI, but yeah, it's Long Beach Island is it's a destination hotspot for people in Philadelphia, and it's mostly South Jersey and Eastern Pennsylvania that when you don't go to Atlantic City, you're going to LBI to spend a week at a bungalow somewhere.
I just think it's a real neat part of the story to reflect on the idea that Captain America was created by two men who actually served in World War II, grew up in the New York, New Jersey area, both Jews, as were the creators of Superman. I mean, the early comics was comic books in the late 1930s, early 1940s, was a lot about Jews fighting Hitler, you know, in the right way they could. Yep. Fighting for their own survival. Superman was an expression of that. Captain America is an expression of that. A lot of these heroes who came out of that realm, that era, have the same roots. And this is not an original insight on my part, but particularly with Captain America, I think Simon and Kirby, in their own way, were expressing their own origin stories through Captain America's origin story. They both fought in the war. They both went to boot camps. They reflected their lived experience through this character.
Yeah, I've always been amazed at Marvel, you know, with Simon and Kirby and later with Lee, that they started making decisions on locales. I mean, even though they're mythical locales, they kind of put them in a definite spot. I mean, you have Smallville, Kansas, yes, but Smallville, Kansas could be anywhere in Kansas. But with with Kirby, and especially with Lee, he chose, this is going to take place in Manhattan, not a metropolis, not a, you know, champion right city, but it's an actual physical location. So you can talk about things like Columbus Circle and where the Baxter Building is located. And when we're watching the MCU stuff going on, Stark Industries is where the Pan Am / MetLife building is in Manhattan, just above Grand Central Station. They're fighting on South Park Avenue during the first Avengers movie. And I for some reason, to me, the equivalent surprise in that I keep thinking about is when they started mentioning product names in TV shows, when they're drinking a Pepsi, and they, you know, it's like they're mentioning a brand name, and it's not connected with the advertisers of the show. It's a surprise to see something that, you know, is there in real life. If you're seeing, you know, it's kind of like watching a James Bond movie, and all of a sudden you notice the Golden Gate Bridge, and you're like, wait, I know where that is. I've been. That's Route One.
That was another innovation that came out of Stan Lee in the early '60s. He set his characters in the real world. He wanted that verisimilitude. Right. Until then, it had all been, like you say, Metropolis and Gotham City and Fawcett City and so forth. Stan Lee said, no, I want these. I forget. There's a quote, and I will look it up before we're done, but it's something like he wanted Marvel Comics to look like the world outside your window.
Yeah.
That Spider-Man occasionally, you know, swung through.
Right, which would be fantastic, frankly. You know, I would love to look out the window and see that. You know, Brian, earlier you were talking about in the comics, Steve Rogers being a private. And did he ever sort of get a commission so that he was the equivalent of a captain that you're aware of? Because I always wondered about that in this film. He's got this private sort of fresh out of boot camp, and now he's super strong, and he's wearing captain's bars. even when he's in Army uniform versus, you know, versus the Captain America itself.
Yeah. Uniform. Not that I recall. Again, I'd have to check. I've got them all in, you know, back issues, not back issues, but omnibuses somewhere. Sure. But I don't think so. In fact, my recollection is as shortly after Captain America's creation, the Steve Rogers persona more or less faded into the background and became less important. And it just became the Adventures of Captain America.
Gotcha.
You know, because we didn't need that secret identity. We didn't need to explain how Cap slipped out or Steve slipped out of the tent in the middle of the night, became Captain America and did this thing. Right. It just wasn't necessary. So, no, I don't think in the comics, I don't think Private Steve Rogers ever got a promotion. In fact, part of the, if you want to call it charm of the early comics was that Private Steve Rogers got picked on a lot. And he was kind of the whipping, you know, the whipping boy of the unit. And then at night he became Captain America, you know? So it was again, that, that revenge fantasy, the same sort of thing of wimpy Clark Kent getting the sand kicked in his face and coming back as Superman later. It was that they played a lot with that with Steve Rogers as well. I don't know why anybody would look at Steve Rogers and think he was a wimp, but
but not after
it worked in the comics.
Yeah. And I wonder if in the film, I kind of assume it's just because, you know, we've decided that you know, the Steve Rogers character is important. So we're going to be seeing him in uniform, not just in the Captain America outfit. And it, would it have just confused people if, you know, in his army pinks and greens, he's Private Rogers. And then he puts on the red, white, and blue, and now he's now we have to call him Captain and call him Sir and stuff like that. I don't have any problem with that.
I don't have any problem with it either. I think it's a real nice kind of straightening out simplification that the movies did that I don't recall ever being addressed in the comic books. Why is he, is Captain America his actual rank? If he got a promotion, would he be Major America? You know, I don't think so. But
and isn't General America a parking lot company that's out in Minneapolis? I think.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like some giant corporation. That's for sure. I do actuarial tables for General America.
Whole life and term.
Well, if there are any listeners who are more freshly up on their World War II Steve Rogers than I am, I'd love to hear what their take on this is.
Definitely, yeah. Well, one last thing that I wanted to mention on Camp Lehigh, the name itself. Lehigh is from the Lehigh Valley, which is northeastern Pennsylvania, and then it's part of the Delaware Water Gap there into western New Jersey. That at the time in the 40s, that would have been one of the major powerhouses of American industry, because in the middle of Camp Lehigh, in the middle of the Lehigh Valley, is Allentown, Bethlehem, Nazareth, Pennsylvania. That's that's kind of the core of U.S. Steel. U.S. Steel was in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Their foundry looked like a crashed Death Star. There was this gigantic steel mill, and it took over most of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. It was, I can remember as a little kid seeing the place, and it just looked like something out of Dante's Inferno. There's just, you know, flames and stuff going up into the sky at night, and it all vanished during the 80s and became, you know, the capital city of the Rust Belt. But at the time in the 40s, the Lehigh Valley was, I mean, the two big things that were there was coal from Pennsylvania, from all up, you know, north in the Poconos, and steel coming from the west, from all along the Great Lakes region, all in this place. It was a railroad center. It had the Central Railroad of New Jersey, the Pennsylvania Railroad, and then its own railroad, the Lehigh Valley Railroad, where steel and coal came in, and coal and steel products went out of that valley. So naming it Camp Lehigh in the, you know, during the middle of World War II, it would be like calling it Camp Cannon Factory. the amount of buildings on the East Coast that are built, and battleships and aircraft carriers and everything else that went out of that part of the world, you know, all came out of Bethlehem Steel. So saying saying Camp Lehigh is it's saying this is where America's strongest force is, and it's in the basic building blocks of America, which, you know, of which Captain right. America was a part of.
And it's where we're forging the arsenal of democracy.
Exactly.
There you go, Hal.
Wow.
Yep. Yep.
It's yeah, you really, you brought it, you know, it's like you laid it up and boom, three pointer. Yeah.
I did all the heavy lifting, Jim.
I had one more narrative thought I wanted to circle back around to, and it was prompted by you at the beginning, Jim. And that is, I think at this point in the movie, we've laid all the pipe, is what how screenwriters refer to it. We've got the exposition done. We know who the players are. We know what they want. And we've set the pins. And now it's time for bowling balls to start knocking some pins down. I mean, Steve Rogers is not Captain America yet, but it's coming. We know that. And we already know all we need to know about Steve Rogers. We've met Agent Carter. We know the general. We know everybody. We know everybody on the playing field. Now we just got to go play the game.
Yes.
And so that's the momentum picking up. All right. We've introduced the players. We've had the coin toss. Now we're going to start playing the game. And it's a great momentum.
Wow. Yeah, no, I
agree.
Great
point.
This is and it's, you know, it all fits in that perfect 20-minute slot of and this is typical for Joe Johnston. I mean, we've been through other movies when we're 20 minutes in on October Sky, that's where poor Homer is blowing up the fence in front of his mom's house. And in The Rocketeer, I believe that at minute 20 is where Neville Sinclair is explaining that he's looking for a rocket, like in the funny papers.
Right.
So this is all following the Joe Johnston playbook of how to tell a story in 2 hours and a few minutes after.
Exactly. Very quickly, speaking of the players that we've met, we would be remiss if we didn't mention the guest on our next episode, who has the absolutely fantastic name of Lex Shrapnel. And we're going to get into that a little bit, but our next episode, we're going to spend some time. We're going to introduce you to the one and only Gilmore Hodge, Your Majesty. So really looking forward to that. That's going to be a fun episode.
Very much so. He was and is and will be a great guest. So make sure you're here next time.
And when we record out of order, our tenses go right out the window.
No, we're
he
just
will
very
have been an excellent.
do we want to pretend we haven't already talked to the guy? Is that how we're going to do this?
I don't think so.
Who could be coming next? What could he be talking about?
I was giving us the option, but clearly
come back next time, folks. He's a wonderful guest. It's a great interview.
Yeah, in Latin declension, it's known as the pluperfect, I think. It would if what if we would know about what's going on in the future. But again, thanks for listening to us jabber away. And if you'd like to continue the conversation, as Brian had suggested, we'd love to hear your opinions on 1940s Captain America. We're always available for the conversation at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget, please subscribe, leave a like, and we also ask, leave a review. You know, if you like us, please, you know, leave us a great review. If you don't, you don't have to leave a great review. If you don't want to, that's okay. But if you do like us, please leave a review at the podcast streaming site where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And please be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.